Everything from inputting victim statements, to tracking evidence, to interfacing with FBI databases that looked for patterns among clues. Then they started working backward to figure out what kind of software should accommodate each need. Every morning, the team conducted a stand-up, meetings where everyone stood to encourage brevity, and recounted the previous day's work and what they hoped to accomplish over the next 24 hours. Whoever was closest to a particular problem or a piece of code was considered the expert on that topic. But any programmer or agent, no matter their rank, was free to make suggestions. In one case, a programmer and a field agent, after brainstorming, suggested that they model part of Sentinel on TurboTax, the popular financial software that reduced thousands of pages of complicated tax laws into a series of basic questions. The idea was basically, investigations and justice for dummies, said Folgum. It was absolutely brilliant. Under the old system, getting approval for that proposal would have taken upward of 6 months and required dozens of memos, each carefully scrubbed of any mention of TurboTax or any indications that programmers intended to simplify federal procedures. No one would have wanted an enterprising lawyer or journalist getting their hands on something that used plain English to explain how the system worked. Under Folgum, though, none of that bureaucracy existed. The programmer and agent mentioned the idea on a Monday, had a prototype ready by Wednesday, and everyone agreed to use the approach going forward on Friday. It was like government on steroids, Folgum said. Every 2 weeks, the team demonstrated their work for a broad audience of high-ranking officials who provided feedback. The Bureau's director had forbidden anyone from micromanaging or making demands. At most, division heads could offer suggestions, each of which was cataloged and evaluated by whoever was closest to that piece of code. Gradually, the Sentinel team became bolder and more ambitious, not just building systems for record-keeping, but linking Sentinel to tools that identified trends and threats and made comparisons among cases. By the time they were done, Sentinel was at the core of a system so powerful it could look across millions of investigations simultaneously and pick out patterns agents had missed. The software went live 16 months after Folgum took over. Deployment of the Sentinel application in July 2012 represented a pivotal moment for the FBI, the agency later wrote. Sentinel, in its first month alone, was used by more than 30,000 agents. Since then, it has been credited with helping solve thousands of crimes. At NUMMI, decentralizing decision-making helped inspire a workforce. At the FBI, it played a different role. Lean management and agile methods helped fuel the ambitions and innovation of junior programmers who had been beaten down by bureaucracy. It emboldened them to come up with solutions no one had considered before. It convinced people to swing for the fences, because they knew they wouldn't be punished if they missed the ball now and then. The effect of Sentinel on the FBI has been dramatic, wrote Jeff Sutherland, one of the authors of the Agile Manifesto, in a study of Sentinel's development published in 2014. The ability to communicate and share information has fundamentally changed what the Bureau is capable of. More important, the way that Sentinel succeeded served as a source of inspiration to the agency and its leadership. The Sentinel experience taught us a lot about how much potential can be unlocked when you give people more authority, Jeff Johnson, the Bureau's current chief technology officer, told me. We saw how much more passionate people can become. You look at some of our recent cases, the kidnapping in North Carolina, hostage rescue situations, terrorism investigations, and in situations like that, we've learned it's critical that agents feel like they can make independent decisions. But empowering people in an agency this size is really hard, Johnson said. That was one of the problems before 9/11. people didn't feel rewarded for independent thinking. Then you look at things like the development of Sentinel, and you see how much is possible. 4. After the agents working on the Frank Jansen kidnapping case inputted the data they had collected into Sentinel, the software and the databases connected to it began looking for patterns and leads. The agents had entered the cell phone numbers the Bureau had collected, the addresses investigators had visited, and the aliases the kidnappers had used in intercepted calls. Others inputted the names of people who had visited Kevin Melton in prison, license plates caught on cameras around Jansen's home, and credit card transactions from inside the stores where the burner phones were bought. Every detail was fed into Sentinel in the hopes a connection would emerge. Eventually, the agency's databases discovered a coincidence. The phone that had sent photos of Frank Jansen to his wife had also made a call to Austell, Georgia, a small city outside Atlanta. The FBI's computers had looked through millions of records from other cases and had found a link to Austell from another case. In March 2013, a year earlier, a confidential informant had given the Bureau the address of an apartment in Austell that he said criminals used as a safe house. That same informant, in a different conversation, had also mentioned an imprisoned gang leader who had put a hit on the female district attorney who prosecuted him, a reference the FBI believed was to Kevin Melton, the man who allegedly planned the Jansen kidnapping. At the time of those conversations, no one inside the FBI knew what the informant was talking about. Jansen wouldn't be kidnapped until a year later. And since then, no one had given the conversation a second thought. The agents who had interviewed the informant weren't even part of the team looking for Jansen. But now, the computers connected to Sentinel found a link. A confidential informant had mentioned someone who fit the description of Kevin Melton, who had allegedly planned the kidnapping. That informant had also mentioned an apartment in Austell, an apartment that, Sentinel had just revealed, might have received a phone call from one of the kidnappers' phones. Someone needed to visit that apartment. The problem was, this was just one of dozens of leads investigators were chasing. There were former associates of Melton's to track down, prison visitors to scrutinize, former girlfriends who might be involved. There were too many potential leads, in fact, for agents to pursue them all. The FBI needed to prioritize, and it wasn't clear that chasing a clue from a year-old conversation was the best use of time. In recent years, however, as the success of Sentinel had attracted more notice within the Bureau, officials had become increasingly committed to using lean and agile techniques throughout the agency. Commanders and field agents had embraced the philosophy that the person closest to a question should be empowered to answer it. FBI Director Robert Mueller had launched a series of initiatives, the Strategy Management System, the Leadership Development Program, Strategic Execution Teams, that were designed to spark, as he told Congress in 2013, a paradigm shift in the FBI's cultural mindset. One particular focus was encouraging junior agents to make independent decisions about which leads they should pursue, rather than waiting for orders from superiors. Any agent could chase a clue if they thought something was being overlooked. It was a law enforcement version of pulling the Andone cord. "It's a critical shift," said Johnson, the FBI chief technology officer. "The people closest to the investigation have to be empowered to make choices about how they spend their time." Sentinel wasn't the only influence behind this change, but it accelerated the adoption of an agile philosophy inside the Bureau. "The FBI's basic mindset is agile now," Fulghum told me. Sentinel's success solidified that. The investigators on the Jansen case had dozens of leads to choose from, but junior agents were encouraged to make decisions for themselves. So two young investigators decided to visit the apartment the confidential informant had mentioned over a year ago. When they arrived at the apartment, they learned it was occupied by a woman named Tiana Brooks. She wasn't home, but her two young children were there, unsupervised. The agents called Child Protective Services, and once the kids had been collected by social workers, the agents began canvassing neighbors, asking where Brooks had gone. No one knew, but one person said Brooks had been visited by two men staying nearby. The agents found those men and questioned them. They said they didn't know anything about Brooks or any kidnappings. At 11:33 p.m., a call came into one of the many phones the FBI had linked to the kidnappers and, as a result, were under surveillance.
"They got my kids," a woman's voice said.
The agents in Austell were told about the call and began questioning their suspects more forcefully. The agents pointed out that the two suspects had recently visited Tiana Brooks. Now the FBI had intercepted a telephone call of a panicked woman, possibly Brooks herself, saying the FBI had her children. In other words, the two suspects had recently visited someone who may be linked to a kidnapping. Was there anything else they wanted to say? One of them mentioned an apartment in Atlanta. The agents radioed their colleagues at the kidnapping command center, and a few minutes before midnight, SWAT trucks arrived at the Atlanta apartment complex the suspects had mentioned. Officers jumped out of the vehicles and ran past dilapidated buildings. They paused in front of one home and rammed their way through a wrought iron door. Inside were two men sitting in chairs with guns next to them, caught completely off guard. The room also contained ropes, a shovel, and bottles of bleach. The men had recently used their phones to send texts about how to dispose of a body. "Get bleach and throw it on the walls," someone had ordered them. "Maybe do it in the closet." An officer in riot gear ran into a bedroom and tore open all the doors. Inside the closet, he found Frank Jansen tied to a chair, unconscious, with blood still on his face from where the assailants had pistol-whipped him. He had been missing for 6 days by then and was severely dehydrated. The police cut him free and carried him out of the apartment, past where Jansen's attackers lay on the floor, hands cuffed behind their backs. Jansen was put into an ambulance and rushed to the hospital. When his wife saw him, she began sobbing. For almost a week, no one had known if he was alive or dead. And now, here he was, with no serious injuries beyond bruises and cuts. He was released 2 days later with a clean bill of health. The breakthrough in the Jansen case didn't occur simply because the Bureau's computer systems connected the dots between his kidnapping and an old, seemingly unrelated interview with a confidential informant. Rather, Jansen was rescued because hundreds of dedicated people worked nonstop to chase dozens of leads, and because an agile culture empowered junior agents to make independent decisions and follow the clues they thought made sense. Agents learn to investigate by listening to their guts and learning they can change direction when new evidence appears, Fulghum told me. But for those instincts to be unlocked, management has to empower them. There has to be a system in place that makes you trust that you can choose the solution you think is best and that your bosses are committed to supporting you if you take a chance that might not pay off. That's why Agile has been embraced at the Bureau. It talks to who they are. This, ultimately, is one of the most important lessons of places such as NUMMI and the Lean and Agile philosophies. Employees work smarter and better when they believe they have more decision-making authority and when they believe their colleagues are committed to their success. A sense of control can fuel motivation, but for that drive to produce insights and innovations, people need to know their suggestions won't be ignored, that their mistakes won't be held against them. And they need to know that everyone else has their back. The decentralization of decision-making can make anyone into an expert. But if trust doesn't exist, if employees at NUMMI don't believe management is committed to them, if programmers at the FBI aren't trusted to solve problems, if agents aren't encouraged to follow a hunch without fear of admonishment, organizations lose access to the vast expertise we all carry within our heads. When people are allowed to stop the assembly line, redirect a huge software project, or follow an instinct, they take responsibility for making sure an enterprise will succeed. A culture of commitment and trust isn't a magic bullet. It doesn't guarantee that a product will sell or an idea will bear fruit. But it's the best bet for making sure the right conditions are in place when a great idea comes along. That said, there are good reasons companies don't decentralize authority. There is a powerful logic behind investing power in only a few hands. At NUMMI, a small group of disgruntled workers could have bankrupted the firm by pulling on don cords needlessly. Inside the FBI, a misguided programmer could have built the wrong computer system. An agent might have followed the wrong hunch. But in the end, the rewards of autonomy and commitment cultures outweigh the costs. The bigger misstep is when there is never an opportunity for an employee to make a mistake. A few weeks after his rescue, Frank Jansen sent a thank you letter to the agents who rescued him. "I have never felt a greater feeling of joy, relief, and freedom than that miraculous moment when I heard a firm American soldier's voice say, 'Mr. Jansen, we are here to take you home,'" he wrote. "Despite the nightmare that I experienced, the fact that I am writing this letter from the comfort of my home is a testament to the many wonderful things that were done by many wonderful people." "It was a calamity that he was kidnapped," Jansen wrote, "and a testament to the commitment of the FBI that he was saved." Chapter 6. Decision-making. Forecasting the future and winning at poker with Bayesian psychology. The dealer looks at Annie Duke and waits for her to say something. There is a pile of chips worth $450,000 in the middle of the table, and nine of the world's best poker players, all men except for Annie, impatiently waiting for her to bet. It's the 2004 Tournament of Champions, a televised competition with $2 million to the winner. There is no prize for second place. The dealer hasn't put down any communal cards yet, and Annie is holding a pair of tens. Her hand is strong, strong enough that she has already shoved most of her chips into the pot. Now she has to decide if she wants to bet everything. All the other players have folded except for one, Greg Raymer, a.k.a. the Fossil Man, a rotund gentleman from Connecticut who carries pieces of petrified bark in his pockets and wears sunglasses with holographic lizard eyes. Annie doesn't know what cards the Fossil Man is holding. Until a few seconds ago, based on how things were proceeding, she figured she was going to win this hand. But then the Fossil Man pushed everything onto the pot and threw a wrench in Annie's plans. Has the Fossil Man been playing her this whole time, luring her into bigger and bigger bets while waiting to pounce? Or is he trying to scare her off with a wager so large he thinks she'll get spooked and walk away? Everyone is staring at Annie. She has no idea what to do. She could fold, but that would mean forfeiting the tens of thousands of dollars she's spent to get to this table, all the progress she's made over the past 9 hours, everything she's worked so hard to earn. Or she could match his wager and bet everything. If she loses, she'll be knocked out of the tournament. If it pays off, though, and she wins this hand, she'll instantly become the tournament's frontrunner, a step closer to paying for her kids' school bills and her mortgage, not to mention her messy divorce and all the uncertainties that give her stomach aches at night. She looks again at the mountain of chips on the table and feels a pressure rising in her throat. She's had panic attacks all her life. Breakdowns so severe that she used to lock herself inside her apartment and refuse to leave. 20 years ago, during her sophomore year at Columbia University, she became so anxious she walked into a hospital, begged them to admit her, and didn't come out for 2 weeks. 45 seconds pass while Annie tries to figure out what to do. "I'm so sorry," she says. "I know I'm taking too long. This is just a really hard decision." Annie focuses on her pair of tens. She thinks about what she knows and doesn't know. What Annie likes about poker are the certainties. The trick to this game is making predictions, imagining alternative futures, and then calculating which ones are most likely to come true. Statistics make Annie feel in control. She might not know exactly what's coming, but she knows the precise likelihoods of being right or wrong. The poker table feels serene. And now the fossil man has blown that peacefulness to hell by making a bet that doesn't match any of the scenarios inside Annie's head. She has no idea how to gauge what is most likely to occur. She's frozen. "I'm really sorry," she says. "I just need a second more." Many afternoons during Annie's childhood, her mother would sit at the kitchen table with a pack of cigarettes, a glass of scotch, and a deck of cards, and play hand after hand of solitaire until the alcohol was gone and the ashtray was full. Then she would stagger to the couch and fall asleep. Annie's father was an English teacher at St. Paul's School in New Hampshire, a boarding school for the sons of senators and CEOs. Her family lived in a house attached to one of the dorms, and so whenever her parents fought about her mom's drinking or her father's lack of money, which they did frequently, Annie was sure her classmates could overhear. She often felt like an outcast at the school, too poor to vacation with the rich kids, too smart to bond with the popular girls, too anxious to be comfortable among the hippies, too interested in math and science for student government. For Annie, the key to surviving amid the shifting tectonics of teenage popularity was learning to forecast. If she could predict which student's social capital was rising or falling, it was easier to avoid the infighting. If she could predict when her parents were arguing or her mom was drinking, she would know if it was safe to bring classmates home. "When you have an alcoholic parent, you spend a lot of time thinking about what's coming," Annie told me. "You never take for granted that you'll get dinner or that someone will tell you when to go to bed. You're always waiting for everything to fall apart." After graduation, Annie left for college at Columbia and soon discovered the psychology department. Here, at last, was what she had been looking for. There were classes that reduced human behavior to understandable rules and social formulas. Teachers who gave lectures on the different categories of personality and why anxieties emerge. Studies about the impact of having an alcoholic parent. She felt like she was starting to understand why she sometimes had panic attacks, why it occasionally felt impossible for her to leave her bed, why she carried this dread that something bad might happen at any time. Psychology, at that moment, was undergoing a transformation brought on by discoveries in cognitive sciences that were bringing a scientific rigor to understanding behaviors that had long seemed immune to methodical analysis. Psychologists and economists were working together to understand the codes that explain why people do what they do. Some of the most exciting research, work that would eventually win a Nobel Prize, was focused on studying how people make decisions. Why, researchers wondered, do some people decide to have children when the costs, in terms of money and hard work, are so obvious, and the payoffs, such as love and contentment, are so hard to calculate? How do people decide to send their kids to expensive private schools instead of free public ones? Why does someone decide to get married after playing the field for years? Many of our most important decisions are, in fact, attempts to forecast the future. When we send a child to private school, it is, in part, a bet that money spent today on schooling will yield happiness and opportunities in the future. When we decide to have a baby, we're forecasting that the joy of becoming a parent will outweigh the cost of sleepless nights. When we choose to get married, though it may seem completely unromantic, we are, at some level, calculating that the benefits of settling down are greater than the opportunity of seeing who else comes along. Good decision-making is contingent on a basic ability to envision what happens next. What fascinated psychologists and economists was how frequently people managed, in the course of their everyday lives, to choose among various futures without becoming paralyzed by the complexities of each choice. What's more, it appeared that some people were more skilled than others at envisioning various futures and choosing the best ones for themselves. Why were some people able to make better decisions? When Annie graduated from college, she enrolled in a PhD program in cognitive psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and began collecting grants and publications. After 5 years of hard work and a successful run of papers and awards, with only months to go to her doctorate, she was invited to give a series of job talks at several universities. If she performed well, she was practically guaranteed a prestigious professorship. The night before her first speech at New York University, she took the train to Manhattan. She had been feeling anxious all week. At dinner, she began throwing up. She waited an hour, drank a glass of water, and threw up again. She couldn't turn off her anxiety. She couldn't stop thinking that she was making a mistake, that she didn't want to be a professor, that she was only doing all this because it had seemed like the safest, most predictable path. She called NYU to postpone her talk. Her fiancé flew to Manhattan and took her back to Philadelphia, where she checked into a hospital. She was discharged weeks later, but even then her anxiety was like a hot stone in her stomach. She went straight from the hospital to a classroom at Penn where she was supposed to teach, and somehow made it through the lecture, so nauseous and jumpy she almost fainted. She couldn't teach another class, she decided. She couldn't give her job talks. She couldn't become a professor. She shoved her research into the trunk of her car, sent a note to her professors saying that she would be hard to reach for a while, and drove west. Her fiancé had found a house that cost $11,000 outside Billings, Montana. When Annie arrived, she determined that, even at that price, they had paid too much. But by then, she was too exhausted to do anything about it. She put her dissertation materials into the closet and settled onto the couch. Her only goal was to think as little as possible. A few weeks later, her brother, Howard Lederer, called to invite her to Las Vegas for a vacation. Howard was a professional poker player, and every spring for the past few years, he had flown Annie out to sit by the swimming pool of the Golden Nugget while he played in a tournament. Whenever she got bored, she would wander inside to watch him compete or play a few hands of poker herself. When he called this year, however, Annie said she was too sick to make the trip. Howard was concerned. Annie loved Vegas. She never turned down a trip. "Why don't you at least find a local poker game?" he said. "It might help you get out of the house." By then she was married, and so she had asked her husband to make some inquiries. They learned there was a bar in Billings named the Crystal Lounge where retired ranchers, construction workers, and insurance agents played poker every afternoon in the basement. It was a smoke-filled, joyless dungeon. Annie went one afternoon and loved it. She went again a few days later and walked out $50 richer. Playing poker down there was this combination of math, which I loved, and all of the cognitive science stuff I had been doing in graduate school, Annie told me. You could watch people try to bluff each other and hide their excitement when they got a good hand. and all these other kinds of behaviors we'd spent hours talking about in classes. Every night, I would call my brother and talk through the hands I had played that day, and he would explain my mistakes, or how someone else had figured out my game and had started using that against me, or what I should do different next time. Initially, she wasn't very good, but she won often enough to keep going. She noticed that her stomach never hurt at the poker table. Pretty soon, she was going to the Crystal Lounge every weekday, like a job, arriving at 3 p.m. and staying until midnight, taking notes and testing strategies. Her brother sent her a check for $2,400 with the agreement that he would get half her winnings. She was up $2,650 by the end of the first month, even after his cut. The next spring, when he invited her to Vegas, she drove 14 hours, bought a seat in a tournament, and by the end of the first day, had $30,000 in chips. $30,000 was more than Annie had ever earned in a full year as a grad student. She understood poker, understood it better than many of the people she was playing against. She understood that a losing hand isn't necessarily a loss. Rather, it's an experiment. The thing I had figured out by that point was the difference between intermediate and elite players, Annie told me. At the intermediate level, you want to know as many rules as possible. Intermediate players crave certainty, but elite players can use that craving against them because it makes intermediate players more predictable. To be elite, you have to start thinking about bets as ways of asking other players questions. Are you willing to fold right now? Do you want to raise? How far can I push before you start acting impulsively? And when you get an answer, that allows you to predict the future a little bit more accurately than the other guy. Poker is about using your chips to gather information faster than everyone else. By the end of the tournament's second day, Annie had $95,000 in chips. She finished in 26th place, ahead of hundreds of professionals, some with decades of experience. 3 months later, she and her husband moved to Las Vegas. At some point, she called her professors at Penn and told them she wasn't coming back. A full minute has passed. Annie still has a pair of tens. If the fossil man is holding a higher pair, say two queens, and Annie stays in the hand, it's almost certain she'll be eliminated from the Tournament of Champions. But if she wins the hand, she'll become the table's chip leader. All of the odds and probability charts floating around Annie's head are telling her to do one thing: match the fossil man's bet. But every time Annie has asked the fossil man a question during this tournament by placing a wager, he's answered with a highly rational response. He's never put everything on the line without a good reason. Now, in this hand, he's pushed all of his chips into the pot, even as Annie has raised again and again. Annie is aware that the fossil man knows how hard it is for her to back down at this point. He knows that, unlike some of the other people at this table, she isn't in the Poker Hall of Fame. This is her first time in front of a million television viewers. He might even know that she's worried she doesn't belong here at all, that she suspects she was only invited because the TV producers wanted a woman at the table. Annie suddenly realizes she's been thinking about this hand wrong all along. The fossil man has been betting as if he has a good hand, because, in fact, he has a good hand. Annie has been overthinking, or at least she thinks she's been overthinking. She's not sure. She looks at her pair of tens, looks at the $450,000 on the table, and folds. The fossil man takes the money. Annie has no idea if she just made a good or bad choice, because the fossil man doesn't have to show anyone his cards. Another player leans over. "You completely misread the situation," he whispers to her. "If you had stayed in, you would have won." A few hands later, Annie has already folded when the fossil man, with a 10 and a 9, bets all his chips once again.
It's a smart play, the right move. But as the other cards fall on the table, they go against him. Even the smartest poker players can be undone by bad luck. Probabilities can help you forecast likelihoods, but they can't guarantee the future. Just like that, the fossil man is out of the tournament. As he stands to leave, he leans over to Annie. "I know the hand you had earlier was really hard for you," he tells her. "I want you to know that I had two kings, and you made a good fold." When he says that, the knot of panic in her stomach melts. She's been distracted ever since she folded against him. She's been second-guessing herself, turning the hand over in her mind, trying to figure out if she played it right or wrong. Now her head is back in the game. It's normal, of course, to want to know how things will turn out. It's scary when we realize how much rides on choices where we can't predict the future. Will my baby be born healthy or sick? Will my fiancé and I still love each other 10 years from now? Does my kid need private school, or will the local public school teach her just as much? Making good decisions relies on forecasting the future. But forecasting is an imprecise, often terrifying science, because it forces us to confront how much we don't know. The paradox of learning how to make better decisions is that it requires developing a comfort with doubt. There are ways, however, of learning to grapple with uncertainty. There are methods for making a vague future more foreseeable by calculating, with some precision, what you do and don't know. Annie is still alive at the Tournament of Champions. She has enough chips to stay in the game. The dealer gives each player their next cards, and another hand begins. 2. In 2011, the Federal Office of the Director of National Intelligence approached a handful of universities with grant money and asked them to participate in a project to dramatically enhance the accuracy, precision, and timeliness of intelligence forecasts. The idea was that each school would recruit a team of foreign affairs experts and then ask them to make predictions about the future. Researchers would study who made the most accurate forecasts and, crucially, how they did it. Those insights, the government hoped, would help CIA analysts become better at their jobs. Most of the universities that participated in the program took a standard approach. They sought out professors, graduate students, international policy researchers, and other specialists. Then they gave them questions no one yet knew the answers to. Will North Korea re-enter arms talks by the end of the year? Will the Civic Platform Party win the most seats in the Polish parliamentary elections? And watched how they went about answering. Studying various approaches, everyone figured, would provide the CIA with some fresh ideas. Two of the universities, however, took a different tack. A group of psychologists, statisticians, and political scientists from the University of Pennsylvania and the University of California, Berkeley, working together, decided to use the government's money as an opportunity to see if they could train regular people to become better forecasters. This group called themselves the Good Judgment Project, and rather than recruit specialists, the GJP solicited thousands of people, lawyers, housewives, master's students, voracious newspaper readers, and enrolled them in online forecasting classes that taught them different ways of thinking about the future. Then, after the training, those participants were asked to answer the same foreign affairs questions as the experts. For 2 years, the GJP conducted training sessions, watched people make predictions, and collected data. They tracked who got better and how performance changed as people were exposed to different types of tutorials. Eventually, the GJP published their findings. Giving participants even brief training sessions in research and statistical techniques, teaching them various ways of thinking about the future, boosted the accuracy of their predictions. And, most surprising, a particular kind of lesson,
Training in how to think probabilistically significantly increased people's abilities to forecast the future. The lessons on probabilistic thinking offered by the GJP had instructed participants to think of the future not as what's going to happen, but rather as a series of possibilities that might occur. It taught them to envision tomorrow as an array of potential outcomes, all of which had different odds of coming true. "Most people are sloppy when they think about the future," said Lyle Unger, a professor of computer science at the University of Pennsylvania who helped oversee the GJP. "They say things like, 'It's likely we'll go to Hawaii for vacation this year.' Well, does that mean that it's 51% certain? Or 90%? Because that's a big difference if you're buying non-refundable tickets." The goal of the GJP's probabilistic training was to show people how to turn their intuitions into statistical estimates. One exercise, for instance, asked participants to analyze if the French president Nicolas Sarkozy would win re-election in an upcoming vote. The training indicated that, at a minimum, there were three variables someone should consider in predicting Sarkozy's re-election chances. The first was incumbency. Data from previous French elections indicated that an incumbent such as President Sarkozy, on average, can expect to receive 67% of the vote. Based on that, someone might forecast that Sarkozy is 67% likely to remain in office. But there were other variables to take into account as well. Sarkozy had fallen into disfavor among French voters, and pollsters had estimated that, based on low approval ratings, Sarkozy's re-election chances were actually 25%. Under that logic, there was a three-quarters chance he would be voted out. It was also worth considering that the French economy was limping along. An economist guessed that, based on economic performance, Sarkozy would garner only 45% of the vote. So there were three potential futures to consider. Sarkozy could earn 67%, 25%, or 45% of the votes cast. In one scenario, he would win easily. In another, he would lose by a wide margin. And the third scenario was a relatively close call. How do you combine those contradictory outcomes into one prediction? You simply average your estimates based on incumbency, approval ratings, and economic growth rates, the training explained. If you have no basis for treating one variable as more important than another, use equal weighting. This approach leads you to predict 67% plus 25% plus 45% divided by 3 equals approximately a 46% chance of re-election. 9 months later, Sarkozy received 48.4% of the vote and was replaced by François Hollande. This is the most basic kind of probabilistic thinking, a simplistic example that teaches an underlying idea. Contradictory futures can be combined into a single prediction. As this kind of logic gets more sophisticated, experts usually begin speaking about various outcomes as probability curves, graphs that show the distribution of potential futures. For instance, if someone was asked to guess how many seats Sarkozy's party was going to win in the French Parliament, an expert might describe the possible outcomes as a curve that shows how the likelihood of winning parliamentary seats is linked to Sarkozy's odds of remaining president. In fact, when Sarkozy lost the election, his party, the Union pour un Mouvement Populaire, or UMP, also suffered at the polls, claiming only 194 seats, a significant decline. The GJP's training modules instructed people in various methods for combining odds and comparing futures. Throughout, a central idea was repeated again and again. The future isn't one thing. Rather, it is a multitude of possibilities that often contradict one another until one of them comes true. And those futures can be combined in order for someone to predict which one is more likely to occur. This is probabilistic thinking. It is the ability to hold multiple conflicting outcomes in your mind and estimate their relative likelihoods. We're not accustomed to thinking about multiple futures, said Barbara Mellers, another GJP leader. We only live in one reality. And so when we force ourselves to think about the future as numerous possibilities, it can be unsettling for some people because it forces us to think about things we hope won't come true. Simply exposing participants to probabilistic training was associated with as much as a 50% increase in the accuracy of their predictions, the GJP researchers wrote. Teams with training that engaged in probabilistic thinking performed best, an outside observer noted. Participants were taught to turn hunches into probabilities. Then they had online discussions with members of their team about adjusting the probabilities as often as every day. Having grand theories about, say, the nature of modern China was not useful. Being able to look at a narrow question from many vantage points and quickly readjust the probabilities was tremendously useful. Learning to think probabilistically requires us to question our assumptions and live with uncertainty. To become better at predicting the future, at making good decisions, we need to know the difference between what we hope will happen and what is more and less likely to occur. It's great to be 100% certain you love your girlfriend right now. But if you're thinking of proposing to her, wouldn't you rather know the odds of staying married over the next 3 decades? Said Don Moore, a professor at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business who helped run the GJP. I can't tell you precisely whether you'll be attracted to each other in 30 years, but I can generate some probabilities about the odds of staying attracted to each other, and probabilities about how your goals will coincide, and statistics on how having children might change the relationship. And then you can adjust those likelihoods based on your experiences and what you think is more or less likely to occur. And that's going to help you predict the future a little bit better. In the long run, that's pretty valuable, because even though you know with 100% certainty that you love her right now, thinking probabilistically about the future can force you to think through things that might be fuzzy today, but are really important over time. It forces you to be honest with yourself, even if part of that honesty is admitting there are things you aren't sure about. When Annie started playing poker seriously, it was her brother who sat her down and explained what separated the winners from everyone else. Losers, Howard said, are always looking for certainty at the table. Winners are comfortable admitting to themselves what they don't know. In fact, knowing what you don't know is a huge advantage, something that can be used against other players. When Annie would call Howard and complain that she had lost, had suffered bad luck, that the cards had gone against her, he would tell her to stop whining. Have you considered that you might be the idiot at the table who's looking for certainty? He asked. In Texas Hold'em, the kind of poker Annie was playing, each player received 2 private cards, and then 5 communal cards were dealt, face up, onto the middle of the table to be shared by everyone. The winner was whoever had the best combination of private and communal cards. When Howard was learning to play, he told Annie, he would go to a late-night game with Wall Street traders, world champion bridge players, and other assorted math nerds. Tens of thousands of dollars would trade hands as they played until dawn, and then everyone would get breakfast together and deconstruct the games. Howard eventually realized that the hard part of poker wasn't the math. With enough practice, anyone can memorize odds or learn to estimate the chances of winning a pot. No, the hard part was learning to make choices based on probabilities. For example, let's say you're playing Texas Hold'em, and you have a queen and 9 of hearts as your private cards, and the dealer has put 4 communal cards on the table. Ace of hearts, king of hearts, 7 of clubs, and 4 of spades. 1 more communal card is going to be dealt. If that last card is a heart, you have a flush, or 5 hearts, which is a strong hand. A quick mental calculation tells you that since there are 52 cards in a deck, and 4 hearts are already showing, there are 9 possible hearts remaining that might be dealt onto the table, as well as 37 non-heart cards. Put differently, there are 9 cards that will get you a flush, and 37 that won't. The odds, then, of getting a flush are 9 to 37, or roughly 20%. In other words, there's an 80% chance you won't make the flush and could lose your money. A novice player, based on those odds, will often fold and get out of the hand. That's because a novice is focused on certainties. The odds of getting a flush are relatively small. Rather than throw money away on an unlikely outcome, they'll quit. But an expert sees this hand differently. A good poker player doesn't care about certainty, Annie's brother told her. They care about knowing what they know and don't know. For instance, if an expert is holding a queen and 9 of hearts and hoping for a flush, and she sees her opponent bet $10, bringing the total pot to $100, a second set of probabilities starts getting calculated. To stay in the game and see if the last card is a heart, the expert needs only to match the last wager, $10. If the expert bets $10 and makes the flush, she'll win $100. The expert is being offered pot odds of 10 to 1, because if she wins, she'll get $10 for every $1 she bets right now. Now the expert player can compare those odds by imagining this hand 100 times. The expert doesn't know if she is going to win or lose this hand, but she does know that if she played this exact same hand 100 times, she would, on average, win 20 times, collecting $100 with each victory, yielding $2,000. And she knows that playing 100 times will cost her only an additional $1,000, because she has to bet only $10 each time. So even if she lost 80 times and won only 20 times, she would still pocket an extra $1,000, which is the winnings of $2,000 less the $1,000 needed to play. Got it? It's okay if you don't, because the point here is that probabilistic thinking tells the expert how to proceed. She is aware there's a lot she can't predict. But if she played this same hand 100 times, she would probably end up $1,000 richer. So the expert makes the bet and stays in the game. She knows, from a probabilistic standpoint, it will pay off over time. It doesn't matter that this hand is uncertain. What matters is committing to odds that pay off in the long run. Most players are obsessed with finding the certainty on the table, and it colors their choices, Annie's brother told her. Being a great player means embracing uncertainty. As long as you're okay with uncertainty, you can make the odds work for you. Annie's brother, Howard, is competing in this tournament of champions right alongside her when the fossil man is eliminated. Over the past 2 decades, Howard has established himself as one of the finest players in the world. He has 2 World Series of poker bracelets and millions in winnings. Early in the tournament, Annie and Howard lucked out and didn't have to directly compete for many big pots. Now, however, 7 hours have passed. First, the fossil man was eliminated by that bit of bad luck. Another competitor named Doyle Brunson, a 71-year-old 9-time champion, was knocked out by a risky attempt to double his chips. Phil Ivey, who won his first World Series of Poker tournament at 24, was eliminated by Annie when she drew an ace and queen against Ivy's ace and 8. Over time, the players at the table have dwindled until there are only 3 players remaining: Annie, Howard, and a man named Phil Hellmuth. It is inevitable Annie and Howard will butt up against each other. The contestants spar over chips and hands for 90 minutes. Then Annie gets a pair of 6s. She starts tallying what she does and doesn't know. She knows she has strong cards. She knows, from a probabilistic standpoint, that if she played this hand 100 times, she would do okay. Sometimes, when I'm teaching poker, I'll tell people there are situations where you shouldn't even look at your cards before you bet, Annie told me. Because if the pot odds are in your favor, you should always make the bet. Just commit to it. Howard, her brother, seems to like his hand as well, because he pushes all of his chips, $310,000, onto the table. Phil Hellmuth folds. The bet is to Annie. I'll call, she says. They both turn over their cards. Annie reveals her pair of sixes. Howard reveals a pair of sevens. Nice hand, bub, Annie says. Howard has an 82% chance of winning this hand, collecting chips worth more than $500,000, and becoming the table's dominant leader. From a probabilistic perspective, they both played this hand exactly right. Annie made the right choice, Howard later said. She committed to the odds. The dealer turns over the first three communal cards. Queen of hearts, queen of clubs, six of diamonds. Oh, God, Annie says and covers her face. Oh, God. The six and the two queens in the communal pile give Annie a full house. If Annie and Howard replayed this hand 100 times, Howard would likely win 82 of those contests. But not this time. The dealer puts the remaining cards on the table. Nine of spades, three of hearts. Howard is out. Annie jumps from her chair and hugs her brother. I'm sorry, Howard, she whispers. Then she runs out of the studio. She starts sobbing before she makes it to the door. It's okay, Howard says when he finds her in the hall. Just beat Phil now. You have to learn to live with it, Howard told me later. I just went through this same thing with my son. He was applying to colleges and he was nervous about it, so he came up with a list of 12 schools, four safety schools, four he had an even chance of getting into, and four that were stretches. And we sat down and started calculating the odds. By looking at the statistics those schools had published online, Howard and his son calculated the likelihood of getting into each college. Then they added all those probabilities together. It was fairly basic math, the kind even English majors can manage with a little bit of Googling. They figured out that Howard's son had a 99.5% chance of getting into at least one school, and a better than even chance of getting into a good school. But it was far from certain he would get into one of the stretch schools, the ones he had fallen in love with. That was disappointing, but by going through the numbers, he felt less anxious, Howard said. It prepared him for the possibility that he wouldn't get into his first choice, but he would definitely get in somewhere. Probabilities are the closest thing to fortune-telling, Howard said. But you have to be strong enough to live with what they tell you might occur. 3. In the late 1990s, a professor of cognitive science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology named Joshua Tenenbaum began a large-scale examination of the casual ways that people make everyday predictions. There are dozens of questions each of us confront on a daily basis that can be answered only with some amount of forecasting. When we estimate how long a meeting will last, for instance, or envision two driving routes and guess at which one will have less traffic, or predict whether our families will have more fun at the beach or at Disneyland, we're making forecasts that assign likelihoods to various outcomes. We may not realize it, but we're thinking probabilistically. How, Tenenbaum wondered, do our brains do that? Tenenbaum's specialty was computational cognition. In particular, the similarities in how computers and humans process information. A computer is an inherently deterministic machine. It can predict if your family will prefer the beach or Disneyland, only if you give it a specific formula for comparing the merits of beach fun versus amusement parks.